morning, counsel. Take your time setting up. I'll just call the case. Our second case is 824-0906. Travis Widner, appellant versus Ace Auto Parts and Salvage Company, doing business as Ace Auto Parts, respondent. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments. We live stream these arguments, but only an audio recording is posted later on our public website. When you begin your arguments, please state your name and the party you represent for the record. 15 minutes each for principal, 5 minutes for rebuttal for the appellant. And with that, the podium goes up and down. So you guys settled and ready? Okay, well then appellant, counsel for appellant, we're ready for you.
May it please the court. My name is Mahesha Subbaraman. It is my privilege to represent Travis Widner, the plaintiff appellant in this matter. This is an Americans with Disabilities Act, or ADA, case. The district court ordered Widner, a disabled amputee and ADA plaintiff, to pay over $89,000 in costs, litigation expenses, and attorney's fees to ADA defendant Ace Auto Parts. The district court abused its discretion for three simple reasons. First, Widner's two supplemental ADA claims were not frivolous. These claims were supported by ADA case law in the Eighth and Ninth Circuits. Widner testified consistently regarding his standing to raise these claims. Ace's own expert rendered testimony supportive of at least one of the claims. And the district court let both claims proceed through two summary judgment orders, a two-day trial, which included a denial of a directed verdict in Ace's favor. Second, the district court systematically erred in applying the Christensenberg standard for when courts may award fees to prevailing ADA defendants. The district court relied on hindsight logic, wrongly confusing an ADA plaintiff's failure to ultimately prevail with frivolousness. Third, by the district court's own reasoning, no jurisdiction existed to grant fees after the court found Widner lacked standing to challenge barriers that he never personally encountered. Now, the district court also erroneously dismissed Widner's ADA claim related to Ace's West Side sidewalk entrance. The court ruled that Ace remediated this entrance to the maximum extent feasible, despite the admission of Ace's own expert that further improvement by way of beveling was possible. The court should accordingly reinstate Widner's sidewalk entrance claim and reverse the fee award. I welcome the court's questions.
So, counsel, you say that there's no jurisdiction under the district court's reasoning and its determination that there was no standing on the counterclaim.
Yes.
So, below, that's not the position you took.
Your Honor, it's jurisdiction, and the point that
I understand.
Sure.
It's jurisdiction. So, my question to you is: are you able to switch positions on appeal? We normally don't allow that. We certainly don't look favorably upon.
Sure. I think it's fair to say that we believe that Widner had standing to raise both of these claims, and we come before this court asserting that. But if the court accepts that Widner had standing to raise these claims, then the district court's frivolousness determination goes out the window, because it doesn't matter whether or not he personally encountered the barrier. So it's kind
of... Your position legally is that it does not matter that Mr. Widner did not personally encounter the barrier.
That's correct,
but
Your
Honor.
But
you did not brief that issue on appeal, did you, counsel?
We did brief that on appeal, Your Honor.
Well, you include some commentary, but you don't challenge the district court's determination.
Yes, we do, Your Honor.
Okay, help me on that.
I believe we do. So in our briefing, we highlight a variety of case law from the Eighth and the Ninth Circuit, particularly the Steger case, in which those courts have concluded that an ADA plaintiff doesn't have to personally encounter every barrier that may be presented within a facility that's been sued. That as long as they've encountered one barrier, then something that they can do is during the course of the ADA
litigation,
send in an expert.
Right, no, and I'm familiar that you have that particular line of cases. What I'm asking you is I don't see that you challenged the district court's analysis or conclusion determination on standing. In other words, that the district court made an error of law in concluding that Mr. Widner did not have standing on the counterclaim.
Well, Your Honor,
I mean, is that in your brief and I just missed it?
Well, Your Honor, I'd have to double check to make sure. But I think that what we essentially argued in our brief was that the district court couldn't have it both ways. And it felt like that was what was happening here. If Mr. Widner had standing to raise these claims, and we believe that he did, then the frivolousness determination becomes problematic because the frivolousness determination was based on the notion that he didn't have standing.
And I appreciate that you're trying to point out an inconsistency in the district court's analysis and in its conclusion, an inconsistency between dismissing the counterclaim for lack of standing and then awarding fees in light of the Fernandez case, I believe, is the primary.
That's right.
That you got. So I see that argument. So here's where I get stuck, counsel, is what if you're asking this court to now reject the fee award based on Widner's lack of standing, doesn't this court need to make a standing determination, apply the correct law, and say Widner lacks standing? We can't simply accept the district court's conclusion.
I think that's absolutely true. It's up to every court to make an independent determination on standing. So if the court wants to look at the standing question, it has essentially two options. It can say Widner did have standing or he didn't have standing. If he didn't have standing, then that dovetails into the question of, does the ADA provision afford jurisdiction to provide fees in a case that's been dismissed for lack of jurisdiction?
Well, what's the standing case law that we apply? As you said, your brief indicates that you think we should follow the Eighth Circuit case law that would say that Mr. Widner does not.
Would ask the court. I know it sounds like I'm kind of talking out of both sides of my mouth here. I appreciate the court, you know, kind of the head spinning nature of this, but when I read this record, there is a head-spinning nature in the district court's reasoning, because it seems that early on in this case, when the court was looking at this case at summary judgment in January of 2022, and then later on in February of 2023, the court basically was telling Widner, you don't have to personally encounter these barriers in order to raise these claims. And then all of a sudden, after trial, through its trial judgment and then the post-trial motion practice, it turns around and says, no, it turns out I changed my mind on that. I think that in order for you to litigate this, you had to have personally encountered these barriers. And because you didn't essentially read my mind about that, then your claims were frivolous from the moment that you started to raise them in October of 2022 forward.
The case is interesting in that most standing issues are decided before trial.
Yes, very much so.
I can't think of a case that's gone through trial, and then there's a finding that there's no standing.
And I would also add, most standing issues, there's usually an extensive body of case law that is precedential and governing in that context. But here, we're dealing with the unusual context of an ADA claim. And there isn't a whole bunch of Minnesota state court case law out there saying, here's what a plaintiff asserting an ADA claim in a Minnesota state court, as opposed to a federal court with the limitations of Article III jurisdiction and whatnot, needs to show. And that puts you then on notice that if you don't have these facts in the record, then your claim is frivolousness or not properly supported.
That brings me to my next question for both counsel. There is a lack of case law in Minnesota specifically, and so maybe this case should be made precedential. And if it should be made precedential, what would your syllabus points be based on this case?
I think that the syllabus points would be, since this case is arising in an unusual, a very unusual context, because the court is almost being asked to decide questions of, essentially is being asked to decide questions of jurisdiction through a frivolousness determination. And what's problematic about that is the underlying case law on the subject is disputed. So this may, to put this in kind of a counterfactual context, imagine that the district court had dismissed Mr. Widner's claim on summary judgment and said, well, you didn't personally encounter the service counter that you complain about, therefore I'm dismissing that claim. At that point, what we could have done is we could have asked the district court to certify the issue for immediate review by this court, or we could have filed a Rule 105 petition. And that way, the court would be able to kind of address in a kind of clean context that issue. Instead, what happened here is this case went all the way through trial on a record in which Mr. Widner consistently testified, before 2017, before my accident, I entered the store. After the accident, I went to the store once in fall of 2019, made it as far as the parking lot, didn't ever go in. And then after that, I've never entered the store. And that was his consistent testimony throughout the entire trial.
Except that's not what his attorney represented to the trial court, as I understand it, leading up to the trial.
Your Honor, we would respectfully disagree with that. We raised these points in our reply brief because really what opposing counsel attempts to do in their brief is they pull out these singular statements in a pretrial motion in limine context and in some statements during trial to say, well, these are examples of counsel asserting that he did enter the store. But the question is, what was the relevant time frame? And he did enter the store before his accident. And that is a relevant factor for establishing standing in terms of intent to return. This is a store I have been to before. I have been inside it before, not after my accident, but I was there. And that helps to establish an intent to return. So the statements that Widner's trial counsel made in this context were entirely appropriate in that. But I will, you know, I'll agree with the court. There's a lack of precision throughout this record about when talking about at what time Widner did or did not enter the store, what time frame is being discussed. Is it the pre-2017, pre-accident time frame, or is it the post-accident time frame? And that lack of precision then, I think, lends itself to a fair amount of confusion on the district court's part. And I'll give you one example of that. If you look at addendum page 66, which is the entirety of the district court's reasoning in terms of why it thought that this fee award was justified, it says that Widner spent it was clear his claims were frivolous, he spent 3 years litigating them. These claims didn't come into the picture until December of 2022 when a supplemental expert report was submitted, and then it was maybe on the table essentially for 8 months through trial, and then in September of 2023 when the court issued its trial judgment. Not 3 years. So there's a lot of temporal confusion that pervades this record.
I want to talk about frivolousness.
Sure.
And the Uselman case, I think
Yes. That's
how you pronounce it, but you know what I'm talking about. So in that case, the Supreme Court observed that attorney fee award wasn't justified in part because plaintiff's lawyer had performed extensive investigation to support the claim. And when I read the record and read the judge's findings about your client's experts, she didn't find it credible.
Well,
and so Uselman had extensive investigation. I don't see that same extensive investigation in this case.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the reason that Uselman is relevant, and I also would encourage the court to look at Revering. It's an unpublished decision of this court, but it really does a good job of compiling all of the relevant authorities. And in Revering, this court says we are reluctant to allow an award of fees for a case where you had a denial of a summary judgment motion or a denial of a directed verdict motion.
I'm going to ask other counsel about that.
Sure. And so you have all of those authorities on the table. But then to speak to the investigation point, I didn't understand the district court's reasoning on frivolousness to be a lack of investigation by the expert. I understood the district court's reasoning on frivolousness to be you somehow represented to this court that he had been inside the store, and then we learned for the first time at trial that he had never been in the store. And that's flatly contradicted by the record because he does testify on page 148 of the first volume of the trial transcript that he had been in the store. But the context for that was, yes, I entered the store before my accident. After the accident, during that post-accident period, I went there once, I made it as far as the parking lot, and then I wasn't able to enter again. And so this, in terms of the frivolousness determination that the district court made here, it didn't say, I find this claim frivolous because I needed to hear more from Widner's expert about the service counter. It basically, what the district court said here was, I think that I've been had. And that it was indicated to me at some point that he had been in the store, and it turns out he was never in the store.
Can I go? Thank you for that. And did that answer your question, Judge Ryan? I want to go back to what I think you want us to hold as a matter of law.
Yes.
That if a plaintiff in a Title III ADA case is determined not to have standing to have brought that claim,
right,
attorney's fees may not be awarded under the statute. So you agree that there are ADA cases, that the ADA case law incorporates the idea of standing, and that if a person does not have an actual injury under those, that standing is a basis for which plaintiffs get dismissed out of cases.
Absolutely.
Okay, let me just set it up because we're running out of time. So let's imagine a case where the plaintiff claims to have been, encountered a barrier. And so, on the face of the complaint, looks good, whatever. Let's say the plaintiff continues that way through summary judgment motions, testifies to that. Then you get to trial, and the plaintiff provides testimony, sure, I was there, I encountered a barrier. Surveillance evidence, everything else proves, no, he was in France at the time. You know? So the district court doesn't find it believable. Dismisses for lack of standing.
Right.
You get all the way through trial. At that point, your argument is attorney's fees may not be awarded. No. Leave aside the frivolousness. Let's say that it's legit to find it frivolous.
It can't be awarded under the ADA.
It can't be awarded under the ADA.
But there may be other provisions.
So why would there be, so you're saying like Rule 11
would
be available?
Rule 11 would be an obvious option in the case of a truly prevaricating claimant or plaintiff.
Yeah, but we're
assuming
that.
Right.
Okay, so you're saying that the court still has jurisdiction to apply its rules and anything else?
Absolutely, Your Honor. We're not arguing that there is no jurisdiction whatsoever to address that type of situation. But here, the district court expressly confined itself in its decision to an award under the ADA. And part of the reason it did that is because if it had decided to rely on Rule 11, and it talks about this in the order, it would have had to provide notice and a hearing. And that would have brought into play additional discussion of Rule 11 cases. And
so because we are out of time and I don't want to spend too long, but I'm wondering about, this is standing, which I know gets discussed in terms of jurisdiction, but when I'm looking at the CRST case,
yes,
the CRST case, which was a Title VII case, that decided that there can be an award of attorney's fees under Title VII, even on a not in that case, it happened to deal with certain EOC pre-suit obligations.
Right.
But it also said that that rule would apply, for example, if sovereign immunity barred the claim or if the claim became moot. In other words, if there are things that result in dismissal of the case fall out. What's the difference between those and standing?
That they're not jurisdictional. Sovereign immunity is a bar to liability. It's not necessarily a bar to suit in all cases. It varies.
Or like they cited an 11th Amendment case, is a bar to suit.
Bar to suit as opposed mm-hmm. to a jurisdictional bar.
Mm-hmm.
The bottom line of it is in CRST, the court was relying back on a case called Mock Mining, in which it talked about this pre-suit obligation to engage in conciliation, to exhaust essentially an administrative remedy on the part of the government before filing a suit. And it said, if you don't do that, then that's
right.
A problem.
I'm less interested in CRST in that part than
right.
I was in the mootness right. or the sovereign immunity.
And I would say that there are kind of three ways you can get a dismissal in a case. You can get a jurisdictional dismissal. You can get a non-merits-based dismissal, which might be something like pre-suit obligation, failure to exhaust administrative remedies, what the Supreme Court has called claim processing rules. And then the third category is a merits-based dismissal, where I look at your claim, it doesn't succeed, and that's the end of it. I would say for those second two categories, that's what distinguishes CRST, and that's what the Supreme Court was pushing back against in terms of the Eighth Circuit's decision. But the Supreme Court had no reason in CRST to address the question of if a case doesn't have jurisdiction to begin with, if there's no Article III jurisdiction, there's no standing, then does the court have independent authority under a statute to raise the issue? And that's an analysis that might have to be made on a statute-by-statute basis, because some statutes and some rules might provide jurisdictions while others might not. And the
okay,
court...
I think yeah. you've answered my
okay.
question for that. Thank you. My colleagues, do you have any questions at this time? Okay. Thank you. You'll
Thank
have
you.
5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel, we're ready for you.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel, My name is Lindsay Woodrow, and I have the privilege of representing Ace Auto Parts and Salvage in this appeal, the respondent in this case. I can genuinely tell the court that the reason we are here today is because this case in October of 2022 became a frivolous case that was litigated in a blatant attempt to survive summary judgment dismissal for mootness after my client spent over $60,000 remediating two parking spaces and an access aisle on their property located in St. Paul. The property became, in October of 2022, or the summer of 2022, frankly, in full compliance with the ADA. Despite that, rather than accepting that, what happened was the appellant and appellant's attorney took it upon themselves to manufacture two new claims to survive summary judgment and this case to trial.
Right, but one of them is not ADA compliant, the West Sidewalk.
It is ADA compliant to the maximum extent feasible.
Exactly.
And that's what the court found.
Right.
And I think if I answer Your Honor's question fully, what we would look at is Mr. Olson's report, the report of LT1 Construction, and the findings that the district court made with respect to those two reports. If we look at Mr. Olson specifically, what we find is that he is not an independent investigator. He is not an independent expert. He is somebody who is neighbors with Chad Thronset of Thronset and Mischenfelder. Thronset and Mischenfelder set up his company for him, recommended he go take the ADA compliance test, took that test.
Before you go into the record, I'm Mr. Olson, and if the other panel members want to hear it, I don't mean to cut you off, but those are not facts about Mr. Olson that I remember the district court relying on in its frivolousness determination. Am I wrong about that?
I disagree with the context, Judge, because what happened was all of the claims were dismissed as lacking merit, right? So appellant went to trial on the claims of the interior countertops and the claims of the west side entrance. And what the court found is that nothing Mr. Olson testified to with respect to those claims or the remediation of the west side entrance was credible. And those claims—
Right. Based on the testimony that Mr. Olson provided, right? I mean, that's how I read the district court's order, and maybe I missed something. Do you feel it was based on based on your briefing, you were going to lack of qualifications or bias or other reasons that the district court could have rejected Mr. Olson, but I just missed that in the district court's opinion.
Those were all findings that the district court made, and those findings
that he was biased and was not qualified?
The findings were all of the things that I had just started to talk about, so that he had this relationship with the attorney's office, he was paid and worked only for the attorney's office, he's paid $1,500 for every investigation he does, that those investigations totaled over 500 over the course of his employment.
And you see those facts as cited as part of the court's frivolousness determination?
I do. I think that's the basis, one of the basis for the frivolousness determination, simply because those claims were determined to lack merit at the conclusion of the trial.
Okay. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, thank you.
So the judge found that Widner did not have standing, and if a court doesn't have jurisdiction over that claim, how does the court have power to award attorney's fees related to it?
I think for two reasons, Judge. First of all, and I think probably the most important reason, is the judge decided in the alternative, irrespective of whether or not her determination on standing was held, that the claim also lacked merit. And so she has the countertop claim specifically. And so what we're talking about is a case that went all the way through trial. And I want to back up just a minute, and I'll answer your question in probably a long-winded way. But when we look at the case from the inception, we look at this concept of standing. And that was addressed at summary judgment, and it was addressed in our directed verdict motion. But what's specific about the case that hasn't been addressed yet is that the district court relied on Davis. That's an Eighth Circuit case. Counsel for appellant at the trial court level understood and agreed that Davis applied to this case and understood and agreed that Davis narrowly tailored the Steger case. So Steger says you don't have to encounter all of the barriers. Davis says, sure, I acknowledge that and agree, but you have to encounter a barrier on an interior of a building. You can't simply drive up to the parking lot, say, gosh, I can't go in, and then make interior barrier claims. That is not the standing. That's not what Davis said, and that's what the court relied upon. Those representations that were made to the district court from summary judgment all the way through trial was that Mr. Widner entered the building as a disabled individual. I also take issue with the concept that as an able-bodied person, so before Mr. Widner's disability in 2017, he somehow gets standing by going into the building as an able-bodied person where he wouldn't have encountered any barriers whatsoever as an able-bodied person. The ADA talks about, in the Steger case, I want to get you the quote, if you give me just one second. The Steger case specifically says that a disabled person has standing to seek relief for any ADA violation in a defendant's building affecting his disability.
But I think here, we're starting from the district court decided he didn't have standing. So, I mean, you're arguing now, let me really say he doesn't have standing, but the district court decided that and that's not challenged on appeal. I think the question is, when a plaintiff lacks standing, what is the jurisdictional basis by which a district court can award attorney's fees? And you said, well, there's an alternative basis here because he lost on merits. Well, the attorney's fees are only going to be awarded if a party loses on a merits, that's a given. You still, I think, need to, let's just take a decision where the district court throws it out for lack of standing based on the evidence that's heard, and that's not challenged, and it's a totally right decision. What would be, you would still argue in that case that attorney's fees can rightly be shifted to the plaintiff. Why?
I think, one, we can look at the plain language of the rule, which talks about a court can allow attorney's fees to any prevailing party.
The statute, you mean?
The statute, okay. Within its discretion, right? And so we've got that as the basis for the starting point of the court does have discretion to order attorney's fees to a prevailing party. It doesn't distinguish what that prevailing party needed to be successful on, whether it be a dismissal for standing or a dismissal on the merits. So I think that's step one. And then I think we go to step two, and the only case that's been cited to this court for the proposition that you can't award attorney's fees if there is no standing is the Fernandez case. And that's a Ninth Circuit case. It's a recent case from 2023, if memory serves. And that case was very different than the case we're here talking about today. That case was a straight up and down motion for summary judgment, one claim that there was no standing, and it was dismissed. We've cited the court to...
I mean, it's Fernandez. I know that you're saying a procedural difference there. And I guess I want to ask you, A, are you arguing that Fernandez is wrongly decided, full stop, that the jurisdiction doesn't, you know, that standing doesn't result in a barrier to attorney's fees? Or are you saying the procedural posture mattered with, or both?
It's both, Judge. Okay. I'm saying Fernandez is decided incorrectly and shouldn't, it's frankly not binding on this court, and I'd ask the court not entertain the case. But I also think it's procedurally different, and we've cited the court to the He case out of, frankly, Guam. It's the only case we can find that has decided or opined on anything similar. And that case, the court did the right thing and said, well, gosh, there wasn't standing on one of the issues, but there was on another, and so we could award attorney's fees. And so that's what I would rely upon. And I think the court makes a good point with the CRST case that that also is going to allow the court to issue an award of attorney's fees on the standing claim.
Do you think this case should be precedential?
I do, Judge. I think.
What would the syllabus point or points be?
I appreciated that my co-counsel got that question first. I had the chance to sit down and write some notes. I think what we would, the syllabus should look like is one that Davis is controlling when it comes to standing on interior barriers, not necessarily encountered by somebody who is entitled to make a claim under the ADA.
Why would we rule on standing? I mean, there's not a challenge to the district court's decision that.
That's a fair point, okay. Judge, but what okay. I hear is that's part of the ongoing discussion, and my concern was appellant's counsel seems to raise the concept that standing may be in play and that you do have to decide standing. If you do, I think the Davis case is the right case to do it, but I appreciate that clarification. Number two, when we talk about the burden shifting, that hasn't been part of our discussion yet today, but I think what I'd like the court to see or to consider in a syllabus is that the Wright versus RL Liquor in the burden shifting analysis is the appropriate analysis in ADA claims. And the Wright case cites the Robert case, which both were, frankly, cited by Judge Gruing in the district court. And in those cases, it says that the plaintiff has the burden to establish, one, that there was a barrier, and then a plausible remediation option to that barrier.
What
then,
if we disagreed with that? Do you lose?
No, we don't lose. We don't lose because the court ultimately determined on the merits that the West Side entrance complete remediation was technically infeasible under the statute and that it was remedied to the maximum extent feasible with its current condition. So I don't think we lose on it. But when we talk about precedent and what we've seen in the Minnesota State Court cases, those issues are still subject to Eighth Circuit opinions and haven't been codified by the Minnesota State Court. And I think to what Your Honor has said earlier, one of the issues is whether or not Fernandez is good law and should be applied in Minnesota. And I take the position that, one, it's wrongly decided, and, two, that it's not precedential in the state of Minnesota.
And just to clarify, and I'm sure this is clear in your brief, but not maybe in my memory, on the burden shifting, you would ask us to follow Eighth Circuit law?
Correct.
Okay.
Yep.
So this is the issue I have with frivolousness. It went through trial, and typically a district court will find something's frivolous pre-trial, but apparently the district court thought there were enough facts out there that were in dispute that it should go to trial. Can you address that if you even know what question I'm asking? It's just kind of this random thought.
No, I think I understand your question, so I'll do my best. The issue with frivolousness in this case really goes to the procedural posture of the file in its entirety. It came in as only a north side entrance case. I've articulated already that that was remediated by my client. And on the eve of that decision being made, what we had is appellant's counsel come to the court and say, well, gosh, hang on, wait a minute. I need to go inspect the remediation that was done to ensure that it's in compliance with the ADA. The court granted that request of the appellant. But then what happened is we have appellant and his counsel, I'm sorry, appellant's counsel and his expert go in to Ace Auto without our knowledge, take some purported measurements that the court found not to be credible, photograph one countertop without consideration of the other 10 countertops that are in existence in Ace Auto, one clearly an ADA compliant countertop that is lower than the rest, ignores all of those things, submits an expert report to the court saying Ace Auto only has one countertop and it's not ADA compliant and that's a violation of the ADA and we get to go to trial on that. Then when it comes to the west side entrance, we have appellant's counsel directing their own expert, and the testimony could not be more clear on this. Mr. Olson was abundantly clear. He does not photograph, he does not measure, and he does not inspect a thing unless counsel tells him to do it. That's why we've got the north side entrance done first, and that's why when that was fully remediated, they had to come out and try and manufacture these new claims. And so when we get to the west side entrance, what we see is he didn't measure any of the alleged vertical rises that he claims were in existence at that time. He doesn't measure anything with respect to the city sidewalk. He simply takes a photograph of one panel of sidewalk, and he takes a photograph of his level sitting on one of the sections of sidewalk leading to the Rice Street sidewalk. That's not enough. He then goes to court and submits that to the judge and says, Judge, look, we've got issues. We've got an ADA violation out there. We need to go to trial on all of those things. So then we proceed to trial on all of those things. And what the court found is, gosh, I've got two competing expert reports, and I think that there's something there, so we're going to go try these two issues. And then ultimately, when we get to trial, he asks for another continuance to go out for a third time and bring another expert out there to try and meet their burden on plausible feasibility or plausible remediation options. And we go out there and we do this thing a third time, and trial is continued, and the court grants them that opportunity. The court gave them every opportunity possible to try and get this right and prove up their claim, and they couldn't do it. And they couldn't do it because it goes to the credibility of Mr. Olson and how they handled this case from the get-go. Mr. Olson was not credible. The court found Mr. Olson was not credible. She believed what he wrote in his report was going to be continued on at trial, and I see my time is out, but I'll just make a note that that's how it's different and that's how it's frivolous.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, and counsel for appellant.
So I want to address a couple of things very briefly. First, I wanted to be responsive to Judge Brotvold's question regarding what our position was on standing, and essentially were we attacking the district court's standing determination in our briefing. And I'd like to take this opportunity to clarify my position. I think in our brief what we're doing is we accept the district court's decision that there's no standing, and then we argue based on that there's no jurisdiction to award fees. But then we say, look, if the court reads the ADA's fee-shifting provision to allow for fees notwithstanding whether there is jurisdiction or not jurisdiction, then we get into a frivolousness question. And on that frivolousness question, to the extent the district court based its frivolousness determination on our alleged lack of standing, we had a fair legal argument that we did have standing. And that fair legal argument is based on Steger and based on the Ninth Circuit cases that we've cited. So we're dovetailing into the frivolousness question when we talk about was there standing here or not. Even if the district court disagreed with us, our point is there was case law to support our position, and that's why it wasn't frivolous.
So then,
and that's on pages 34 and 35 of our opening brief.
So Your then Honor. If there isn't standing with regard to the counter,
mm-hmm.
therefore no attorney's fees.
Assuming that that's the way the provision operates.
But there was standing with regard to the West Side sidewalk.
Well, there are two problems.
Did you get into frivolousness? Or?
Well, there are two problems there. One problem there is obviously the fact that the theory on which the district court relied for standing, saying you have to personally encounter a barrier, equally applies to the West Side entrance because Mr. Widner testified at trial, I never encountered the West Side entrance. So it would seem that that theory, if you're going to apply it consistently, would knock out standing on that claim. But then alternatively, we argue, well, the real reason you can't award fees on that, assuming that there is standing there, is because we had a meritorious claim and that the district court overlooked our remediation argument in terms of beveling. And that's the second point I wanted to hit on because it wasn't all that much discussed when I was up here initially, and that is we have the uncontroverted testimony of ACE's expert when asked the question, could you make this situation better by beveling the 2-inch lip that you claim will occur? She said yes. She didn't say it's impossible. She didn't say it's going to make the situation more dangerous. She said, yes, it'll make it better. And that's what the ADA is designed to do. It's not designed to be used as a weapon by ADA defendants to say, well, because we can't make it ADA compliant, better that we do nothing. Instead, it says, look, if you can make it compliant, great. If you can't, do it to the maximum extent feasible. And here, ACE's own expert testified that there was something more that could be done. So the claim couldn't be deemed frivolous at that point. Now, to go to the jurisdictional point for a moment, opposing counsel says there are no other cases out there other than Fernandez. And I think on the ADA point, that's true. But in advance of this argument, I did research to see, has this issue arisen with respect to other fee-shifting statutes? And it has in the Eighth Circuit and in Minnesota. The case that the court might want to look to in terms of the Eighth Circuit is a case called Keene Corp versus Cass. That's 908 F. 2nd 293. It was decided in 1990, and the court was dealing with Section 1983 for civil rights claims and Section 1988, which allows for fee awards in that context. And the court said, we agree with the district court that it lacked subject matter jurisdiction under Section 1983. That lack of jurisdiction barred an award of attorney's fees under Section 1988. And then we have a Minnesota case. It's a bit of a tougher fit, but it is, I think, illuminative. It's Johnson versus Johnson, 97 Northwest 2nd, 279, 1959 case, and the court was dealing with Minnesota's divorce statute and the question of whether that statute allowed for an attorney's fee award after the divorce proceeding had been concluded and the court lost jurisdiction. And what the court said in that case was, we've concluded in a bunch of earlier cases, there's no jurisdiction to award fees after the divorce proceeding is over. But guess what the legislature did? It added a bunch of language to say you can award fees in those cases after they've been dismissed. So the legislature and the court have recognized there has to be some express statutory language, and that doesn't exist in the ADA. I heard opposing counsel say that the language of 42 U.S.C. 1225 says you can award to any prevailing party fees. It doesn't say any. It says the prevailing party. And that's an important distinction, because any could be very broad, but the prevailing party is indicative of the fact that this is not a provision that has a fee-shifting mechanism for jurisdictionally dismissed cases built into that. I see my time has expired, but I'm happy to answer any other questions that the court may have.
No, thank you. Thank you both for your briefing. Cases submitted. It would have been helpful. I was thinking, what are other fee-shifting statutes? And I was looking for the briefs for, let's look at other fee-shifting statutes. So for lack of standing, and attorney's fees coexisted in the same case. I don't know if, of course, there is a way, if there's a, for supplemental authority to submit.
I would be happy to submit it through a supplemental letter.
Yeah, why don't you go ahead and do that. Thank you. The case is submitted. I appreciate your arguments very much. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period. Thanks.